Hello, this is an hour, and as you've noticed, we've started our show today without any kind of introduction, or our usual introduction, I guess. Our Charles Ives had been left at home, and we've started straight with a piece by our guest today, Mr. Lawrence Crane, who is with me today. Very good to have you, Lawrence.
Hello.
Hi. You'll notice that this was not just a fluke. We've decided to start this program today with this piece just because I think that there's such a big difference between not only this Ives, this kind of opener, which is very flamboyant, but there's a difference between that and most of the music that I've played around the show. And I think that it kind of creates an island, and it's straight into this piece, Raimundas Rumsas, right? I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly still after having rehearsed.
I think so.
Right,
Raimundas
Rumsas. This is a piece from 2002.
Yes.
And it's for cello with a very strange bow. It's called the Bach Bogen.
Yes.
And made by, let's see, Michael Bach.
Yes.
Michael Bach.
A German musician who invented or has built a bow that can play all four strings of the cello simultaneously. Normally, you can obviously arpeggiate with a normal bow, and you can play two simultaneously. But this, you can actually play three or four strings simultaneously with this bow. And the cellist on that recording, for whom the piece was written, is an English cellist called Anton Lukashevich. Not an English name, you might say.
Yeah, I thought so, yeah.
He's of Lithuanian descent,
right.
But born and brought up in England. Anton commissioned this piece from me to write using the bow. And with Anton's Lithuanian ancestry, the title Raimundas Rumsas, Raimundas Rumsas is a real person. He's he was, when I was writing the piece, a Lithuanian racing cyclist who finished third in the 2002 Tour de France.
All right, that's not bad.
So the piece, the two lower strings of the cello are tuned a tone lower than
they usually
the normal,
are.
Yeah, to B flat and F. And the piece, I suppose, you can sort of tell that it's not a normal bow, I suppose. It has,
right.
Not only can you tell that there's more strings than two being sounded, but it has also a particular sound quality, I think.
Yeah, it seems as if it's, I don't exactly know what it is, but I mean, it's very difficult to tell because you've never heard the cello so full. So
right.
There is something different in the sound, but of course, had I heard this without knowing that this was a special bow, I would have, of course, thought that this was two cellos or some kind of manipulation.
Right. Yes.
But in fact, it's one cello. And the fact that Anton Lukashevich plays this himself, actually, means that any cellist can actually pick up the bow and play with this bow on a normal cello. It doesn't necessitate any kind of practice or special practice. I mean, if I were a cellist, I could probably use that bow.
Yeah, I think it would you'd have to spend a bit of time getting to know the mechanisms of the bow, but certainly it's a normal cello. It's just a slightly different bow.
Right, so he plays it on his normal cello.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
Let me just kind of, before we even start and go into details, let me go into a short bio for you, Lawrence Crane, for those of you who are not all completely familiar. Lawrence Crane was born in Oxford in 1961, studied composition with Peter Nelson and Nigel Osborne at Nottingham University. He lives and works in London, which is where we are today, recording from our very provisory studio in Shepherd's Bush. Has nothing to do with the BBC. And his music is mainly written for the concert hall, although his list of works include pieces written for film, radio, theater, dance, and installation. It also states here that you are closely related with the British Ensemble Apartment House, which Anton Lukashevich is a part of.
Yeah, he's actually the founder and artistic director of Apartment House. Yeah.
And they've championed your music here in England, I have to say. They had more than 40 performances of your works.
That's right, since 1995 when they formed, yeah.
Right, so that's quite amazing. I mean, that's quite a feat for any ensemble.
Yes, it is.
For any composer, I should say.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a great piece for me to start, not only because I think that it's just the harmonies are very luring and kind of just a great opener for a piece, for a program, but also this is quite interesting for me because it's a good insight into your style in general, which I don't know if I can find a word for. I was thinking about this week. I was thinking maybe you are a minimalist. But then again, I'm not so happy with that because minimalism, one thinks immediately of the Americans, the 70s, Steve Reich, John Adams, so on and so forth. maybe Morton Feldman. Do you call yourself a minimalist? Do you call yourself anything, in fact?
Not really, no. I mean, I think you're right about the term minimalism. It actually points to a point in time, doesn't it, in musical history of
the
1960s, 1970s America. If I were to use the word minimal, it would be to do with the sort of pared down nature, I suppose, of my music, because I use very simple musical objects, very stripped away, common chords, triads, things like that, scales, simple scales or very fragments of melodies, and also almost exclusively tonal, but not in a normal context. They're like objects from tonality, but presented in an unfamiliar context. So I think the term experimental has been applied to my work. The term minimal certainly has been. I think that piece shows a certain facets of my work which are quite common. There's a certain single-mindedness, it's a single idea piece, it's tonal harmony, it's very static, you know, it doesn't move, it doesn't go anywhere, it sits there like an art object, I suppose, in a way. And it's, I think that the harmonic rhythm does not change, you know, at all. So those are all characteristics, I would say.
Yeah,
and also a certain degree of sustain as well, which you'll hear
true.
In a certain amount in some of the other pieces, that drone-like sustain, I suppose, which you'll definitely hear in some of the other pieces that we're going to have today.
I can't really compare you to anybody again, but this is interesting. I think of somebody, for instance, and forgive me for the comparison immediately, but somebody like Arvo Pärt, who came from a tradition of, I should say, avant-garde experimentalism, late 60s, early 70s, and then suddenly went, well, through a religious phase, obviously, which he's still in, and then suddenly created this music, which is very tonal, very different, let's call it, from what he used to do before. For those who know his, at least his symphonies, he's got three symphonies in which the third, there's kind of a emergence of this new modal style. This was always your style. This was never a kind of a breakthrough in your personal life. You've always created this stuff, meaning that it's something very deep inside you that actually veers toward this kind of drama. Let's call it a musical drama.
Yes.
Am I wrong in saying that?
No, you're not wrong at all. It's my first works date from around 1983, 1984, when I was I was 22, 23 years of age, and just immediately after leaving university. So I'm finishing my studies. So yes, it's true to say that I've always written like that. I never had
religious crisis.
No, I never. Well, I stopped being a Roman Catholic at the age of 20. But
were you before?
I was. Yeah, I was brought up a Roman Catholic, but I enjoyed the music actually in the Catholic Church. But I'm no longer a believer. So. I don't think that constitutes a religious crisis. I think a lot of people give up at that stage.
Yeah, there's still hope for you, Lawrence. Don't worry.
Thank you very much.
We'll pray for you.
Thank you very
much. Everybody in Chalice Radio will be.
I'm extremely grateful.
We're very welcome. This just before we go on to our next piece, because we have so much music to play today, and I really like to play as much as we can. My first introduction to you was, I think, when I was a student at The Hague, and it's funny to me because I think that I probably talk about The Hague each and every time I go on radio, which kind of makes makes a good publicity for their school. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that, but I think you were brought into one of our sessions by. Who was it, in fact?
By Richard
Ayres, of
Richard
course.
Ayres,
Richard, wonderful Richard Ayres.
Yes.
Kindly presented you to us. And it's true, our Monday night meetings are a very kind of argumentative sort of, how shall we call it, gathering. It's definitely not like the approach that one has towards seminars here in the UK, that's for sure.
No, it's more like a bear pit.
It is really, isn't it? But I must admit that it is kind of been dictated by above, from above. I mean, this is something that really is the ideal of the school.
Yeah.
Regardless of that, I remember that at the time, many people had arguments with your music. They didn't really understand exactly what you are trying to do. And I'm assuming that this is also true for me, because I at first thought, well, definitely, I don't know how to pinpoint what it is that I'm hearing, which is very difficult for any person taking composition as a profession, vocation, let's call it. you must find a way to at least pigeonhole what it is that you're hearing. It makes everything so much easier, I find. Not only that, once you're hearing something which is so familiar, which is, in fact, your musical materials are so, so familiar, but on the other side, you're doing something with them that I don't think anybody has done. You've been compared to Satie, and even that is different in a way. I mean, there's a difference between how somebody like Satie treats the material. My question actually is, how do people react to your music? Is it usually the case? Do usually people find it very difficult to stomach? I mean, because there is a dichotomy between how simple and immediate the materials are and how the form, shall we say, is completely different. And this is quite fascinating because I think that for me personally, this music completely grew on me. For at first I thought, this is quite odd. And then the second listening, I thought, well, this is quite, but there's something there that really lures me in. And today I can't imagine a world without this music. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a shift. It's a personal shift. But I wonder, how do people react?
I do get extreme reactions. Think that, I mean, people do have very strong reactions for and strong reactions against. I'm interested that it's grown on you. I think that happens as well to people.
Yes.
I'm quite happy with that. I think, I don't go out of my way to create that situation. I mean, what I'm doing is doing, you know, what I believe in as a composer. I like to listen to music that brings strong reactions. The extremes in music are the ones I'm most interested in. I think so. Maybe it's in my personality.
I'm sure it is. Yeah. I'm sure we'll get into your personality further in depth. But let's listen to some more music before we do. So that was Raimondas Rumsas.
Yes.
From 2002.
Yeah.
What we're going to listen to now is something different. It's piano pieces. It's actually three very short piano pieces.
Yes.
They relate more to your style, I should say, before the past years. Let's call it the pre-2000. Just to make it easier for me.
Yeah.
Because you used to write much shorter pieces. And today you veer towards trying to write bigger forms, bigger structures. These piano pieces are performed by another British composer, Michael Finnessy. Michael Finnessy is interesting in that sense because he writes completely different music, but he's a great champion of your music. I'd just like to read an excerpt from this CD, what Michael Finnessy actually says about your own work. So in his words, Lawrence's music has no pretensions to being grand. It's pretty much at ground level. But somehow that's eventually much, much grander in terms of the essential human condition. It's a music which has buoyed up and enriched my life since I first heard and played it 20 or so years ago, and growing up with it has been an exquisite privilege and excitement. Like Satie, here's that mention again, it has a masterful actuality, transcending local styles, but in a reservedly melancholy way. It's also saturated in history. I love its discomforting and ever-fresh extremism. I also rejoice in its extraordinary care and perfect choices, the voicing of chords, the surprises lurking round what you're led to think are safe corners. Nothing is safe here. I respect and admire its attention to detail and its characterful, probably out-of-step, discourse. It's alive, being itself. So Michael Finnessy in his own words. Just before we continue this discussion, let's hear these pieces. So we're going to hear three separate pieces, straight with no breaks between them. The first is called 20th Century Music. This is from 1999. Just after that, we're going to be listening to Looking for Michael Bracewell. And just after that, we'll listen to Chorale for Howard Skempton. This is from 1997. So, three pieces by Lawrence Crane, three piano pieces, all played by the English composer Michael Finnessy. That was, again, the first piece was 20th Century Music from 1999. Then we had Looking for Michael Bracewell. This was 1989. And then, finally, that beautiful chorale for Howard Skempton, 1997. Mm. We've just spoken about this while the piece was going. We've both attended this Cutting Edge concert in which I think it was a new piano piece of yours was performed.
Yes.
Long distance. Correct me here.
The title is Piano Piece Number 23, Ethiopian Distance Runners.
Okay.
Which actually is my most recent, or one of my most recent pieces written earlier this year. And that is an attempt to write a long single movement piano piece, because all my previous piano pieces have been short miniatures, anything between 1 and 6 or 7 minutes.
Right.
Single idea pieces. And these are the ones that Michael has recorded on the disc that we've just played. And this most recent piece is an attempt to make a long single movement piece, but using the same kind of material that I've been working with in the miniature pieces. It's sort of what I've become interested in, making longer structures over the last 10 years.
Right. Well, this interesting thing for me, that the concert really featured some of the most extreme voices, I should say, regardless of the musical style, the extreme voices, let's call them the avant-garde of Britain today. And I feel that here, more than other places in the world, these type of composers, they tend to stick together more than other places, just because maybe there's such a vast difference between these groups of people that create experimental music rather than the mainstream. Because there really is such a vast difference. There's also a vast difference in the way that they are, let's say, treated by the musical establishment, which is quite interesting for me, because I hear this more and more from composers here in Britain about, I shouldn't say a maltreatment on behalf of the establishment, but definitely a looking away or looking in a different direction from those voices creating experimental music and those creating what would be conceived or perceived as mainstream music. How have you felt that yourself in your compositional life?
I think one of the things with British music is the extraordinary. So there's some extraordinary composers in Britain, I think, extraordinarily original composers and fascinating composers, despite the fact that as a sort of community, as it were, the contemporary classical music scene is very underfunded, certainly if you compare it with certain other countries. And I think I heard someone say recently about a situation in another European country, which I can't quite remember which one it was. But anyway, they said that there's no experimental music there, because once the state get a whiff of it, they take it on. So it becomes there's no possibility of becoming subversive. So I think, I mean, when I travel to other countries to hear my music played in other countries, I do get this sense that people really are interested in what's happening in Britain. And this despite the fact that we're all sort of, you know, doing all sorts of other things to survive.
Could I ask you a follow-up on that, though? Yeah. Because the interesting, we've also just brought this up in passing just now. How does this relate to a sort of a class system or money in the UK? This is something that I've only got a whiff of whilst being here, not really being British, not really knowing the scene that well, but having lived here a few years. A lot of composers, especially experimental composers, talk about money. Coming from money?
I think what I would say about this is that I think it would be hard not to say that there's definitely some sort of a class system in the British contemporary classical scene. Mm. On the one hand, that's bad because it reminds me of an old socialist phrase or a sort of rallying cry, 7% of the population own 84% of the wealth. Actually, in Britain, if you want to know what socialism is, you probably need to look it up on Wikipedia, because it's practically died out, unfortunately. But this very much describes to me the British contemporary music establishment. On the other hand, this means that people like me and people on, as it were, the margins of this society can do what we want. You know, we're not trying to please anyone. We can make our own creative decisions and not be trying to please A or B, who we think is going to program us if we write like this or write like that, because that does happen.
Well, I think that's a fantastic answer. I've also actually felt that way myself many years, but I thought that there's, especially with a scene in Israel, which I'm sure you know nothing of, and I grant you that there's nothing to know, but it's quite interesting, because if you try to be avant-garde there, most of the avant-garde composers just think, you know, we're being robbed, basically, by a mob of pseudo-Mahleristic and Strauss composers, even Verdi at times.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to advocate, actually, the avant-garde needs that. It needs that negation. Yeah. I'm not sure to what extent, but it does need it. It relates to me, actually, even more so to the next piece which I'd like to play, which is The Movement for 10 Musicians. This is from 2003.
Yes.
why does this relate to the movement? Because this was picked up. We're going to hear this performed by the Ives Ensemble. In fact, it was written for the Ives Ensemble.
Yes, it was. All right. Yeah. Well, actually, there was an earlier version of the piece written in 2002 for a Dutch ensemble, Orchester Ehrenpreis. The artistic directors of the Ives Ensemble, John Schneiders and Richard Rijnvos, fantastic Dutch pianist and composer, Richard Rijnvos. John Schneiders, the Dutch pianist, and Richard Rijnvos, the composer, heard that, and they were looking for a piece to use in a collaboration with Rotterdam Dance Works, the dance company. So they commissioned a new arrangement, because my original was for a very Dutch ensemble of, you know, the Dutch have a lot of ensembles with a lot of wind and guitars, you know, woodwinds, brass and guitars, saxophones. And that's what the original was for. I went for a more classical instrumentation, which I'll tell you now, shall I?
Yeah. Please do.
Which is flute and clarinet, both with doublings, horn, trumpet and trombone, electric organ, bass marimba, vibraphone, violin and cello.
Right.
So I did this new version for that instrumentation.
And they've put out a recording of this. This is quite amazing, because they've put out this recording as a commemoration of how many years for the Ives Ensemble?
20 years. 20 years. Yeah, I mean, originally they did 6 performances with choreography with Rotterdam, and then performed it as a concert piece on several occasions. And one of those performances in Amsterdam was recorded for this commemorative CD to celebrate their 20th anniversary in 2006.
Right.
So it's a live concert recording, but a sort of available CD.
Right. This is interesting, because this is exactly what the Dutch ensembles, in fact, do. They've kind of turned the tables completely on the aristocracy, shall we call it, of the musical vogues in Holland.
Yes.
And everything is avant-garde.
Yes.
In a way, very similar to what you said, I don't think that there is really an avant-garde now in Holland. It's quite strange that all of the avant-garde is kind of, well, it sounds the same for sure, and there seems to have become now a style of what it is to be a Dutch composer of that style.
Yeah.
But still, it's a wonderful thing that they have these ensembles still working, still championing very young composers, and not only Dutch composers, but as we see, English composers as well.
English and Irish as well. Gerald Barry, and also Andrew Hamilton.
Both, that's right.
Composers from the Republic of Ireland, and fantastic composers.
That's right.
Yes, I mean the Ives, of course, are well known also for their fantastic recordings of the music of Morton Feldman and of John Cage.
Mm.
This piece is a single movement. It's 15 minutes long, and it was one of the first where I tried to see how I could make a longer structure with the same sort of static tonal materials taken out of normal tonal context.
Let's give it a listen. So this is a movement, or just movement, for 10 musicians from 2003, the Ives Ensemble, Lawrence Crane.